Hi, I'm Al Majoros. I am a three-year cancer survivor. My blog, The Cancer Warrior, is one of the top 10 breast cancer blogs, according to blogs.com. I'm here to bring a fresh, upbeat perspective to a topic that to some may seem scary. A positive mental attitude got me through my cancer, and I hope to share that with you. I'm very excited about today's guest. We have on Matthew Zachary. He is the founder of StupidCancer.com, a great organization that I found online when I was just diagnosed. Through Stupid Cancer, I started a blog, and because I believe I blogged on Stupid Cancer and eventually had my own blog, thecancerwarrior.blogspot.com, I believe that Matthew Zachary helped me to be the blogger that I am today, as well as the advocate that I am today. So let's meet Matthew Zachary, a great cancer advocate and someone who's helped a lot of young adults deal with stupid cancer. How are you today, Matthew?
Good afternoon.
So let's jump right in, because you have such a great story to tell about yourself and your organization. How did you find out that you had cancer?
Well, first off, Mel, thanks for having me on the show.
Long overdue,
and it's my pleasure.
Yes.
I was a college senior, mm-hmm. 6 months shy of graduating from college, and I started to experience a bit of a peripheral neuropathy in my left hand. Ironically, I was a pianist at the time on route to film school, so I noticed it very acutely and usually earlier than one might normally do if they weren't a concert pianist.
Right.
Went to the campus doctors. They didn't quite know what was going on. I kept going back to the campus doctors, and I was misdiagnosed with everything from Epstein-Barr meningitis to carpal tunnel and a mini stroke.
Oh, my goodness.
At one point, they just thought I had the flu and gave me Robitussin.
They didn't think you were pregnant, did they?
Ultimately, we found out that I had a large brain tumor lodged in my cerebellum. And that was discovered on December 27th, 1995, pretty much exactly 6 months before I was supposed to graduate from Binghamton University in New York and go to the University of Southern California's film school to study composition. And I asked the doctors, when you take this tumor out of my head, am I going to play again? And they said, let's just hope you're alive in 6 months, and then we'll worry about it.
Oh, my gosh.
So not the kind of response you want to get.
No.
When you're just leapfrogging into your life. After 4 years of an amazing undergraduate experience. So that is how that all started. I had a very invasive brain surgery on January 10th, 1996, and it wasn't until a week later that they discovered that it was actually malignant. Up until that point, they had thought it was benign, which still would have meant I would have needed radiation and all that,
right.
But that there was no necessarily life-threatening situation.
They didn't do a biopsy for 10 days?
It took a week for the pathology slides to get back, because I'm guessing, I don't really know the answer to this, but I'm just assuming that the doctors are like, what? You take a look at this. What? You take a look at this. No, you take a look at this. It turns out that I had something that was so exceptionally rare that they had to invent a new name for it.
Oh.
Yes. So the tumor that I had is typically called a medulloblastoma. It's one of the most common, if not the most common, pediatric brain tumor out there, and it's lethal. It's terrible. It has 20 years ago, it had like a 20% survival rate. When I was diagnosed, it was up to 50, which is what they gave me, 50%.
Wow.
But mine had weird muscle tissues in it, and they had to rename it. They'd never seen it before. And the interesting thing about medulloblastoma is that it typically occurs in children under the age of 8, and yet somehow I was 21.
Did you get to name it after you, like they do with the comets and stuff?
Oh, it's the Hale Bopp Matthew Zachary tumor. Is that what you want?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes, they did.
No, what is it? What is it called?
They called it a medulloblastoma.
Okay.
Which is just bizarre that I have my own tumor named after me. So maybe someone can buy it as a gift or something.
There you go.
Yeah, there you go.
Makes a great Christmas present.
So once they found that it was malignant, then they had to rush through a whole battery of options for post-treatment. And because this was not an off-the-shelf cookie-cutter situation, I was bombarded with 75,000 different options, and the greatest doctors in the world couldn't tell me what to do with myself. And ultimately, I had to make my own decision. There was no internet.
Right.
There was no PubMed. There was no WebMD. There was no Medline. None of this stuff existed. And the paperwork was just from, you know, like the American Cancer Society and the group called the American Brain Tumor Association. So nothing really specific for me as a young adult in college, you know, who just wanted to graduate and go do his thing and was told he never play piano again, let alone live for 6 months. So that was my little entry into the world of cancer survivorship.
So what did they have you do for your treatment?
I had one doctor on one end basically say, we want to give you like a year of bone marrow transplants and invasive chemotherapy and full body radiation. And on the other end, I had like the tree hugging hippie saying, oh, just go home, you'll be fine. You know,
take some more Robitussin?
Yeah, have some bark and kale. This will take care of you. So I'm stuck in the middle here at 21 years old with no idea what to do. So we basically just picked the middle.
Right.
And the middle was full body radiation with the possibility of chemotherapy depending on how well I tolerated it. I think it's important for your listeners to understand that 15 years ago, radiation was the primary means of treating cancer. Chemotherapy had not evolved to where it is today.
Oh, really?
And the treatments of radiation back then are like the elephant tranquilizer versions of what they give today.
So they basically put you in a microwave?
It's more like Chernobyl.
Oh.
We calculated that the dosage of radiation that I received to my head, neck, and spine, all the way down to my coccyx, was the equivalent of 3,000 lifetimes of sunbathing every day of your life.
Wow.
So, happy day.
So you don't have to tan anymore.
No, I am. I don't quite pick up the paper clips anymore with my fingers, but that was a little bit of a novelty trick I had for quite some time.
Wow. So how long did you have your radiation for?
It was only for 33 days.
Only?
Which, you know, I mean, I say this because people have years of treatments, and life's not a contest, but in those 33 days was probably compressed 2 years of chemo into 33 days in terms of the toxicity and the side effects. And, you know, I wouldn't wish what I went through on my worst enemy. They don't do what they did to me to anyone else anymore.
Well, that's good.
It's very good. I don't want that to happen to people.
No, absolutely not. So, you and I both.
Mm-hmm.
You and I both, for sure.
Exactly. So the problem, of course, is that it's a moving target. They don't necessarily know what my side effects are going to be. They can't use my experience to help anyone else. And the fact that I was 21 going through protocols they would normally give an 8-year-old, you know, were a weird recipe for future predictions.
Wow. So you had your radiation, and then they just said, well, I guess we'll see what happens.
Well, I was treated by some incredibly aggressive, highly conservative pediatric neuro-oncologists who were steadfastly committed to my getting like a year of chemo when I was done. And it's important to note that the radiation nearly killed me on its own.
Oh.
I lost 110 pounds in 3 months. My entire muscle mass and the capacity to eat and drink.
Wow. So how much did you weigh before?
I was, well, the steroids puffed me up like that marshmallow guy from the movie. And I was a big guy. I was probably pushing 280 at the end, but 50 or 60 pounds of that was all steroids. I dropped down to 170 by May 17th, my graduation. And then I guess kept losing weight because I was hyperthyroid from the
radiation.
From the radiation. Unfortunately, that went away and I became hypothyroid. It stopped losing weight at some point. Anyone that looks at my bio now will see that I'm telling the truth.
Yeah.
A recent headshot or whatnot.
And I think they need to tell people that about radiation, especially with the head, neck, and torso, because
right.
I'm hypothyroidism too.
Right. It's synthroid all the way.
Yes.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And they don't really, you know, I mean, they do tell side effects more, I'm sure, than when they did when you were going through it, but I think they need to tell more of the side effects. I'd rather have, like, what I call the wine list of everything.
Here's what you can whine about.
Yeah. Well, no, it's like, no, thank you. I don't want any of those. But I'd rather know everything that may happen than someone just go, well, it probably won't happen. You don't need
well,
to know about
it. They gave me this little pamphlet that said, you know, it had like 20 symptoms on it. And it said, please check off the symptoms you may experience and bring this card with you every day. So within like 3 or 4 days, I took like a giant industrial strength Sharpie and like X'd out the whole thing. I experienced every potentially horrible life-threatening side effect from radiation you can imagine, with the exception of like third-degree burns on my skin.
That's surprising because a lot of people get burns on their skin from radiation.
Yeah, I'm the whitest guy around. So
you are.
I'm impenetrable.
So you luckily got through all the radiation. How long did the side effects take to clear up?
It's been about 15 years so far. Yeah. So they keep changing. It's fun. It's the gift that keeps on giving.
Oh, I know. I get my neuropathy, then it goes away, then it comes back.
Yeah. And I mean, the conclusion of my cancer story ends when I went back to the doctors after graduating as this wan, pale, skeletal figure who was unrecognizable by anyone who knew him in January of that year. And they basically said, all right, let's gear you up for your chemo. And I was like, well, what does that increase my survival rates to? I think I said my exact words are, when the hell am I going to die?
Right.
Because I felt so bad. And they were like, you have a 50% chance of surviving for 5 years, given the treatments we've given you. Statistically, if we give you the chemotherapy, and I said, what, like 80, 90%? They said 55%. So, you know, it was just so interesting that they would even consider being so glib as to want to subject me to a year of high toxic chemotherapy after they nearly killed me
With your radiation.
You know, with the radiation for 5% efficacy on 5 years, which is just another 3 months.
Right.
You know, of time. The most interesting part of that recommendation was that the chemotherapy they wanted to give me contained a drug called vincristine, which many people may be familiar with. It is extremely toxic, and one of the side effects that it causes is peripheral neuropathy, which is what I had before I got diagnosed that finally went away. So here we are with a pianist who couldn't play but had the possibility of building his skills back up again, subject to the potential of getting the side effect that caused him to be able to stop playing in the first place prior to being diagnosed. So my sentiment was, I'd rather die in 5 years without vincristine than live for 5 years and 3 months.
Oh, exactly.
With it, and risk not being able to play piano again, because that was my quality of life.
Exactly, because that's what you love to do.
Right, that is exactly what it was. So I walked out the door, I never looked back, and, you know, here I am 15 years later. Sort of a house of cards, so to speak, but
right.
You know, you do the best you can.
So now, as you were going through your treatment and ultimately your survivorship, I know that you found it, I'm too young for this. How did that come about?
Well, I mean, it took like 10 years for me to even consider my role, not that I even knew I had one.
Right.
You know, in the national cancer conversation, I was just a guy who got a job after college because he couldn't go to grad school and worked in the cubicles. You know, I was Dilbert for a while. And, I mean, it was fun. I enjoyed it. It met lots of people, and it gave me an opportunity to build that new normal, which is a term that I hate, but you kind of have to use because there's nothing else
right.
You can substitute in for it.
We got to come up with a new phrase for that, by the way.
The ishkabibble.
Ishkabibble,
I got to rebuild my ishkabibble. And, you know, it was just good to reinvent myself and to meet people who didn't know I was sick. But I was just like everyone today who gets sick. I was afraid.
Mm-hmm.
I was bald. I was skinny. I couldn't recognize myself in the mirror. I couldn't play piano. I was impotent. I couldn't feel comfortable with myself inside my own skin. I was irritable. I was still nauseous. I was isolated. There was no peer support.
Right.
You know, all the stuff that still happens today happened to me. People lose sight of the fact that I actually was sick at one point in my life, and I've been through all this stuff before, just like them. So I can completely relate to everything everyone goes through these days that we address. It took me a good 5, 6, 7 years to sort of feel like I was okay. Obviously, that magic 5-year cancerversary is a big deal for a lot of people. For my case, statistically, didn't matter.
Right.
Because there were no statistics for me. So, you know, 2-week cancerversary was just as good as a 20-year cancerversary. So, I think what happened was, you know, I started to play piano again a little bit. It took me a couple of years to rehabilitate myself. I would never play at the quality or competency that I did before I got sick ever again. That was for sure.
But people wouldn't realize that, though. Like, if I heard you play piano, I mean,
right.
I know my fiancé is a guitar player, and he's had some back issues and stuff, and he sounds great, but, you know, I'm sure he's the same way you are. We're just like, yeah, that sounds awful.
Right, but any artist is their own worst critic.
Exactly.
You know, no one knows anything different from anything. And I mean, going back to my undergraduate, there was a theory we had. It was called a 98% theory. And one of my professors expressed this where, like, within any given, like, higher art form, 98% of the people who listen or view it or experience it won't know the difference from anything else. And if you're a really good artist, you aspire to impress the 2%.
That's true.
Right. Your goal is to win over the 2% because the 98% are won over by default.
Exactly.
So that goes back to that. I'll never win over the 2%. The 98% will be very happy, you know. But I actually released two albums within a year of each other, self-produced of my own music that I wrote, which were expressive of my going through cancer. And they're all solo piano music. And, I mean, it's funny to be able to write for, you know, symphonies for orchestras to be reduced to a piano, you know, was very creatively, you know, challenging. Because I had so much I wanted to get out, but I couldn't play or perform. Or I no longer had access to an orchestra, for that matter.
Right.
Which I did at school. but my CDs, you know, they got out there. Drug companies bought them back in the day when they could, and they gave them away in the hundreds of thousands, you know, I kid you not, you know,
wow,
to doctors and patients all over the world. So I built up this strange notoriety unwittingly and got invited to speak and perform at all these cancer organizations I'd never heard of before that I wish I knew, you know, at the time 5 or 6 years before.
Right.
And around 2002, that's really when I first met, like, Doug Ullman, who's now the CEO of Livestrong. I met folks from an organization called the National Coalition for Cancer Survivorship. I met a group called the Children's Cause for Cancer Advocacy. And they started to woo me and cultivate me. I guess they saw some potential that I could do spokesperson work to understand disparities and survivorship issues and clinical research, whatever, you know. And
right.
I sort of got thrust into it, quit my job, started a boutique, I need to make money on the side type of thing. I met my wife, we got engaged, we got married. And then I wanted to experience a lot of these young adult things that I didn't know about. So I went to a Planet Cancer retreat. I went to a Camp Make a Dream summit. I applied for a financial assistance scholarship. I sat on the board of 2 or 3 young adult organizations or committees. I joined the Livestrong Young Adult Alliance. You know, these were all things that happened in like 04, 05, 06. And then I realized, you know, that there was just such a gap in the communications realm for young adults. No one was really connecting dots.
Yes.
No one was serving as the ad agency, if you would, for the young adult movement. The pimp, if I may use a politically incorrect euphemism. But that there needed to be a national brand that homogenized and synthesized all of the young adult angst out there, all of the communities out there. And, you know, we're still not there in any way, shape, or form, but I think that by launching the I'm Too Young for This Cancer Foundation, like officially in January of 2007, and here we are at the tail end of 2010, we've made a big dent, and I think it served the purpose that it was put out to originally, which is not to reinvent the wheel, but to basically be everyone else's advocate and coalesce the communities that were very siloed in their own world.
I think you made a huge dent because I think you're, like you said, 2007 was when you first started I2Y, right? Around
yes.
there? Yeah, I mean, that's when I was diagnosed, and I found you probably online somewhere, and I started blogging. And finding people like myself who are going through the same things that I were, I mean, you know, I live in a small town, and it's hard to find people my age who are going through what I'm going through. And sometimes you just don't want to meet people in person. You know,
no, but it comes down to the fact that people are entitled to have access to resources.
Oh, exactly.
And you're basically doing a disservice if you're disenfranchising them. You know, the easiest thing to say is that, you know, where were you when I needed you?
Right.
And we get that a lot. Where was I2Y when I was diagnosed 2 years ago or 3 years ago or 4 years ago? And my response is, where was I when I2Y? Like, where was I when I needed me in 1996? You know, like, it just goes back. It's an interesting, you know, cycle. But I'm very excited at where we're at as an organization today. I think we've really achieved what our initial mission was. Our work's not, you know, we got our work cut out for us, because behind every success is 10 doors that need to be opened.
Exactly.
And, you know, I kind of hearken to what we do to a little bit like spackle. You know, we see a crack, we see a gap, we try to fix it because no one else is paying attention to it.
And one of the things that I like that we talked about at the Cancer Treatment Center Empowerment Rally was all of the cancer groups seem to be fractured. Like, there's the breast cancer group and the lung cancer group and everything. And I think you and I are on the same mission of bringing, and as well as Stand Up to Cancer, bringing everyone together and saying, look, we got to treat the body as a whole. We got to come together. You know,
well, it speaks to the philosophies of epidemiology and collaboration in this country. I mean, Everything's very siloed because the nonprofit structure forces it to be that way. You know, business is all about money and the bottom line, and that forces you to be competitive. So there's a flawed infrastructure in this country from a corporate perspective, whether it's business or nonprofit, where you're forced to be protective and territorial. And then organizations that are open and collaborative come around, and they're perceived as, you know, frenemies and, and conflicts of interest and whatever. The interesting thing about young adults, though, is that it is not really a disease-specific cause.
Right.
It's an age-specific cause. So when you take the body parts out of the equation, it becomes much more sociological than clinical.
Exactly. And like I said, we were talking about everything is about our survivorship and how we feel, regardless if you have brain cancer or breast cancer or anything else.
Right.
I mean, we all go through the same things. I mean, luckily, no one will be Chernobyl'd like you will ever again, but at least you can say, hey, I know what it's like survivorship-wise, not feeling like you should and being bald and just being like, what the hell's happening to me? And that's the way I felt for a long time, too. And then when I found your group and I finally found Facebook, it was like, oh, it's not just me. And I think being a cancer survivor, sometimes you feel very alone.
Well, I mean, it also speaks to this issue that, you know, when you're diagnosed with cancer at any age, it's devastating.
Oh,
but
it's...
when you're in your 20s or 30s, it's a very different dynamic.
Right.
It's a very, very different dynamic. And a lot of people tend to not think that young adults get cancer. I remember when the New York Times did a piece about us a week or two after we launched, believe it or not, one of the comments on the article online basically said, I had no idea that people in their 20s got cancer.
Ugh.
It's just not even in the mind's eye.
Right.
So I'd like to think again that the young adult movement, whether we've been a catalyst or not, is now part of a national conversation. And, you know, with programs like yours and programs like Fertile Hope and the Live Strong Alliance and even our radio show, the Stupid Cancer Show, which now has, you know, 300,000 listeners worldwide, we're giving a voice to a generation that didn't have it, and not only making people aware that young adults can and do get cancer, but that we matter in the conversation. We have very different needs specifically.
Right.
And that we need to be paid attention to.
And especially, like, there was some article about how mammograms aren't that important. I don't know if you read this article.
Well,
and they said, well, we tested these people who are in their 50s and 60s, and it's like, well, that doesn't apply to me. That doesn't apply to my friend, you know, Christy, who is 24 and she was diagnosed.
Right.
You know, I mean, you can't just say, well, it doesn't really matter that much for people in their 50s and 60s. Well, that's great, but, you know, I'm not 50 and 60, and neither are, you know, I'm sure you know people who are in their early 20s who are diagnosed with anything, who, you know, CAT scan or, you know, whatever, scan X, maybe they don't say it helps them if they're 50 and 60, but what about us?
Right.
You know.
Exactly.
I mean, that's the great thing about your organization. It's like some, you know, I can call you up and say, hey, what's going on? Or I'll have a friend who needs something. And I know that I can either talk to you or Jack. Well, maybe not Jack, but...
Maybe not Jack.
Or Aaron or somebody in your group. And, you know, even if they're too shy to talk to you, you know, there's always somebody out there who will be your intermediary or find the information that you need.
Yeah, and I mean, I can't make any promises, of course. Not with respect to that, but I mean, like, I want to see this organization grow huge, but I wanted to try and maintain its sense of, like, human connection, and
right,
that we're real people and we're not high and mighty executives in a cloud somewhere that travel the world and do whatever, you know, and have billion-dollar bank accounts or whatever. I mean, I want to be able to maintain the integrity from which the organization was started, not lose people, you know, who may perceive us as leaving our roots. The organization was started with a lot of hostile, angry aspersions, and
right.
You know, we don't really do that anymore, for obvious reasons, because you know we kind of have to play nice in the sandbox, but we're not competing with people. We'll let everyone else shoot themselves in the foot and just offer better service and product.
Right.
That's just good business. But, you know, criticizing other groups is not really what we do.
Oh, no. No, I didn't mean that. But I just meant, you know, like I said, if
but I want to be able to answer a phone if someone calls me. And I want to be this person with, like, my assistant's intern.
Right.
You know, is taking notes on behalf of someone on the phone. You know, I don't want to be that person. I never want to be that person.
Oh, yeah, me neither.
Keeping us reachable and accessible.
And I don't criticize any groups either, regardless of, you know, how I feel. Because, you know what, my opinion, I'm on the radio. I mean, what difference does it make if I like something or not? You know,
right.
That's what I think. You know, I always tell people, well, I can give you what happened to me as advice, side effects wise or anything, but you really need to talk to your doctor.
Yeah.
Because don't say that Mel said this because, you know, I push buttons all day. You know, and so what's in the future for I2I and Stupid Cancer?
Well, I mean, I think the three biggest things we'd like to grow are the radio show.
Yes.
Our listenership and the quality of our guests and the quality of our dialogue is really unique in healthcare. I mean, we have topics that aren't even cancer-related
right.
that trend very high with huge listenerships. And I just think we're on to something that's really big,
mm-hmm.
and it could be a huge property in the media space in healthcare. I also would like to keep growing our annual conference, which is called the OMG Cancer Summit in New York. We have hundreds of people that come every year. We'd like to grow that to thousands over the next couple of years. I'd like to see the OMG Summit become like a TED event or South by Southwest, where
mm-hmm.
it's a convention or an expo, CancerCon, if you would.
I like that. You need to trademark that.
I did already, and I own
did
it.
You?
So, yeah.
Awesome.
So, but there are always ambitions and lofty goals to have, because if you don't think big, you don't grow big.
Right.
I'd like to see our website become more of an integrated portal of opinions and content. And I just like to see more homogeneity in the young adult community. I mean, from an outcomes perspective, I'm not a doctor or a researcher, but I'd like
right.
to. We won't have anything to do with this directly, but I'd like to see young adult epidemiology, tissue bank studies, clinical trials, and research
exactly.
exist in the first place. That doesn't happen right now. I'd like to see new standards of curriculum for the next generation of residents, interns, and fellows. In medical education. I'd like to see social workers and nurses in training at school and undergraduate and graduate get edified about the needs of this patient population and how to be a better servant to healthcare and to their patients.
Right, because at my hospital here, they have a big survivor dinner, and I felt like, and I know this sounds bad and on PC, but I felt like I was at the 5 o'clock dinner at Denny's because I brought my fiancé, and we were the youngest people there. And while it's inspiring to see, you know, 30, 40-year survivors, it's like, okay, well, I'd like to talk to somebody my own age about the issues that I have and that we have. And that's what's great about your organization. Did I lose you?
No, I'm here.
Okay.
I'm nodding.
You're nodding. I can see that.
Yeah.
And you have an amazing guest coming up on Monday.
Yeah, we have Lisa Niemi. I think I pronounced her name incorrectly. Lisa Niemi, maybe, perhaps.
Yeah.
She is the wife of the late actor Patrick Swayze,
mm-hmm.
and she's going to be talking about her experiences with him and pancreatic cancer, which
yes.
is not a young adult disease, but again, it's about compelling content, great guests,
right.
and bringing value to our listenership.
And I just did a show with somebody with PanCan, and they said there's only a 6% survival rate right now.
Well, again, it is one of those like orphan cancers where
right.
there's been like zero improvement, and it's nearly impossible to get funding for it, because it is such a statistically small percentage of all cancers. And again, this goes back to the larger picture of, you know, if you take the body parts out of the equation and you start to look at things on the genomic level, there are ways to address, you know, translational research that could benefit anybody, regardless of where the cancer is.
Exactly.
And we're hoping that is something that moves forward very quickly.
And that's our goal here as well as on the Cancer Warrior. So we're all on the same page.
Yep.
So, Matthew, if people want to get a hold of you, how do they do so?
Well, our website is stupidcancer.com,
mm-hmm.
and people can reach me at info@stupidcancer.com.
And you're on Facebook and Twitter as well.
I'm the only Matthew Zachary on Facebook, apparently. And I'm
really?
The only Matthew Zachary on Twitter, apparently.
Okay. But that's also Stupid Cancer, or I2Y.
Yeah, I2Y is our nickname, but right. Stupid Cancer is our tagline.
Right, because it is Stupid Cancer.
It's really Stupid Cancer.
Well, awesome. Thank you so much, Matthew, for joining me today. I'm going to wrap it up like I usually do. I am the Cancer Warrior. You can always find me on Facebook because I am a Facebook junkie. Become a fan of the show, The Cancer Warrior, on EmpowerRadio.com on Facebook. Check out my blogspot, thecancerwarrior.blogspot.com. And you know what? Life looks pretty good from where I'm sitting. Sending you good vibes. It's The Cancer Warrior on EmpowerRadio.com.